Hello, Robin Williams. What next? Well, first stop, that World Center for Top Tech, the California Institute of Technology, Caltech. And now it's set to embrace a way to fondle the future so it's manageable and not just a confusing surprise. Michael Alvarez is Professor of Political and Computing Social Science. What is a social scientist doing at Caltech? You should be an engineer or a physicist, shouldn't you?
Well, Caltech has had a long tradition of involving social scientists and humanists. We're unique, I think, among many of our peers here in the U.S. in the STEM field, in that we require all of our undergraduates to take one class a quarter in the humanities and social sciences. So it's an important aspect of the undergraduate education here, and we do play an important role in the research mission of the Institute.
And that's what we say in Australia. It's not just STEM, it's STEAM. You STEAM, add the STEAM. Arts.
Okay. I think we need to add the social sciences in there too. So maybe it's STEAMS.
And what's the new center you're setting up?
Well, we're trying to help Caltech position itself in the world of public policy. So what we're trying to do is trying to help improve the communication of our scientific research into policy conversations here locally in Washington, D.C., but also bring those policymakers to campus so that we can better understand their needs, their desires, and learn how we can more effectively collaborate with them to try to solve a lot of the pressing problems that we have today.
Do you think many of the scientists will be willing to leave their benches and leave their fields and come across and jaw?
Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. What we have found is that so far, most of our colleagues are already doing work that is policy relevant in some way. And they recognize the importance of really pulling the policy relevance out of their research, because ultimately a lot of the work that we do is funded by the federal government. It's funded by nonprofits and other organizations. And so explaining the importance of what we do to society is increasingly important in today's world. Where we do see a lot of excitement as well is from our students, the next generation of scientists, because the younger generations today are much more interested in doing science and doing scientific research. That's important for the world. That's solving real world problems. So the task for us is a lot easier when it comes to working with students and postdocs at Caltech.
Which three areas are you going to concentrate on to begin with?
We've decided to focus on climate and sustainability, bio and medical ethics, and the ethics of AI. These are three areas at Caltech where we have a lot of research strength. And of course, they're really important problems in today's world.
Huge, each one. AI, you know, for example, it's impossible to do an interview on the Science Show without mentioning AI in some shape or form.
Right, AI. So we mentioned it, but we are actually very active in the space right now, trying to understand very rapidly evolving area. And we're trying to understand what policymakers really want to focus on. But we also are trying to understand the technology as well, and where the technology is going to be headed over the next couple of generations so that policymakers can try to get ahead of it rather than to continually being responsive or reactive to changes in technology.
One of the hazards with such a center is once you've had effective discussions over a period, you want to take action. Whatever the hands-off policy might be of your members, nonetheless, they'll think, I want to push things along a bit. Is that a hazard for you?
Of course it's a hazard. We have to be very careful, in particular myself, because I'm a political scientist, about trying to avoid getting actively involved in politics, in particular partisan politics. But there's a difference between working with policymakers who oftentimes are appointed officials or career bureaucrats is kind of a pejorative, but they're career people who work in these jobs. And so working directly with them is a very nonpartisan, very non-political task. And that's really the focus of our work.
And then there's the problem, especially in this age of making rather loud noise, shouting, should we say, where people aren't listening, they're shouting, of enabling people to listen, having the kind of atmosphere where a discussion can take place in a civilized way.
Mm-hmm. That is a really big problem, trying to create really a safe space for these kind of conversations to occur. For example, what we've been doing as part of our mission of our center has been focusing on building workshops and conferences where we can bring academics and policymakers and others into a relatively safe environment where they can talk about controversial topics. So in September, we had a conference at Caltech on conspiratorial thought and its implication for science and trust in science. That's a very controversial topic. And yet by bringing the right people to campus, we had a wonderful 2 days where we talked about a lot of the basic science in the area, how to improve that research, but also how to move that field forward so that we can understand the role that conspiracy theory plays in preventing us as scientists from communicating our work effectively to the public and to stakeholders.
As an observer, would you say that conspiracies are made, manufactured, if you like, as a sort of weapon so that you can have disarray and therefore more control?
Sometimes. You know, sometimes they're deliberately formed with political purposes in mind, literally to block progress in areas or to misinform people and misdirect people in terms of how they think problems arise and what they think is important. But oftentimes they evolve from the grassroots. Oftentimes they arise from people's misunderstandings of politics or their need to understand things better. So they're sometimes more benign, but in general, they do oftentimes block our ability as scientists to really communicate effectively what we're doing in our science and how it matters and what we can do to affect policy change.
It's almost a kind of relative of violence because, as most people can see now, if you really want to change the whole system and just march through it and make things completely different, create a fight, create a war. And that really is seeming to spread in the most unfortunate way.
Now, a lot of that has to do with our online communications, you know, with the evolution of the internet, with the evolution of web technology, with social media. And information is being weaponized in ways that it hasn't been weaponized in the past. It's so much easier today to easily build a conspiracy theory using AI to build generative technologies, to build fake images, deep fakes, to build, like we saw in New Hampshire recently, a seemingly fake Joe Biden telling people not to vote in an election. Those types of things are so easy to produce today, and they're so easy to disseminate. So information has been weaponized in a way that it's not been in the past and has become this sort of tool of online political combat.
There's also a picture of society, a kind of atomization of what used to be called a society with its cohesions. Is that going to affect your debates and your discussions?
Well, I don't think that it's as binary. What I think has happened is that the world's changed. What used to be perhaps thought of as a society has moved to an online space. The people who I interact with daily 30 years ago would have been people who were physically around me, my colleagues in this building, my family. Today, many of those people I still interact with, but I am increasingly likely to be interacting with people online. So the nature of society and the nature of community has changed. And for us, what that means is that the way that we need to think about communicating has to change. That's an issue, of course, with many of my colleagues, trying to work with them to be more proactive about talking about their science on social media, to use blog sites, to think about podcasts, to think about all these alternative technologies and different ways to approach these new types of communities and these new types of societies is a bit of our challenge.
And part of the challenge, is it young people? I know here and at the Ivy League universities, dare I mention Harvard, you would have a wonderful selection of bright, informed people. But in general, some of us find the younger generations, especially the boys rather than the girls, terribly disconnected. Do you?
Disconnected from whom and what?
Getting together as a community in that way.
Well, again, I think they work in different types of communities than the world I grew up in. For example, I've never used TikTok. And yet the younger generations, many of our students, my daughter is an avid TikTok user. And so trying to understand how that is a community and how these tools like TikTok can be used to better inform the younger generations, to keep them from being susceptible to conspiracy theory and misinformation, is really the big trick today for the work that we're doing.
It's not a coincidence that you said the equipment I'm using at the moment is the oldest you've ever seen. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've had a great time.
Social scientist Michael Alvarez at Caltech in Pasadena.